This is a true story.
The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in Wisconsin and New York in 2017.
At the request of the survivors, the names have been changed.
Out of respect for the dead, the rest has been told exactly as it occurred. Better Call Fargo edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the Lenny to my Squiggy and the St. Hubbins to my Smalls, it's Dan.
Good early evening, Scott. I'm not mobile this week, and no, I don't know what the hell kind of voice I was doing in the intro there. It was just a weird fucking voice, so.
F-bomb in the first minute. Yeah, I was trying to figure out, like, okay, you're not really doing an accent there. You probably could do it, considering where the region that you hang out in quite often, but I was like, I don't know what he's doing, but I'll let it go, because I'm known to suddenly go into weird, bad, squirrely accents for no reason, especially during karaoke, quite frankly.
Yeah, I probably should have done a British accent there, but I don't know what the hell that was. It just happened. But fortunately, the TV episodes we're here to discuss are much better than that really, really lame voice that I started out with.
Indeed. Wow, do we have stuff to talk about tonight. So, you know what? Let's get right to it with the latest episode of Better Call Saul. Now, that latest episode was titled Chicanery. It was written by usual staff member Gordon Smith, who was also the main guy behind episodes such as 5-0, Rico, and Gloves Off. And also interesting is that it was directed by Daniel Sackheim, who is a very well-accomplished producer and director who's helmed any number of TV series episodes, from an Emmy Award-winning turn on NYPD Blue, shows like The X-Files, House, Game of Thrones, The Americans, and oddly enough, this past week's episode of The Leftovers. So, last week...
Yeah, he's having a good week.
Yeah, it's, you know, he pretty much knocked it out of the park, you know, back-to-back nights. I mean, obviously, it just worked out that way, TV schedule-wise, but it's pretty cool. So last week, other than the fact that you were going mobile and on the way to Indianapolis at the time, we chatted about that episode that was split pretty evenly down the middle between the Jimmy and Chuck storyline and the Gus, Mike, and Hector storyline. But this week, I think we got kind of a rarity. This was all about the McGill brothers this week.
I think it was nice timing, too, because, I mean, the show, I mean, we've definitely been talking about the stuff going on with Mike and Gus and Hector and whoever a little bit more. And now we have a nice, really awesome example of that. Oh, we don't need any of that. And the show is just like just as good as everything else on television, if not maybe a little bit better.
Yeah, absolutely.
So nicely done production team and everybody.
Yeah, they planned it out really well. I mean, yeah, we know that the Gus Mike stuff, you know, it scratches our Breaking Bad storyline itch. Like, oh, if Breaking Bad had an extra season kind of thing, you know, in a way that, you know, seeing even future Saul Goodman lackey Huell show up in this episode wouldn't be able to do. But this, I think... this was just really superb storytelling that they built up throughout the previous season, and at least to a certain extent, really culminates here. And and there's, you know, there's a reason I picked a couple old Michael McKean roles from the past in our intro, because, you know, obviously the way that Jimmy and Kim's plan relied on Chuck acting a certain way, this episode really leans heavily on McKean's performance. I mean, everything from the opening flashback right down to that closing meltdown, which is like something out of like the Caine Mutiny or A Few Good Men or something like that. So he's become quite the, maybe not quite as polarizing a figure as he might have been in the first two seasons, because he's taken on much more of a villainous persona this year. But let's talk a little bit about Chuck, and I don't really mean more platitudes about how good McCain's performance was, because at this point it goes without saying, but really like the nature of his relationship with Jimmy here, like that flashback, for example. I mean, I wasn't expecting a flashback like that, which I love when we get stuff we don't expect, which is quite often on the show, I think. But I felt that really told us a lot of things. I really enjoyed them giving us that, before we got to present day again.
Yeah, it was a nice scene, and really, I mean, it really sold the way the episode ended. I thought it was kind of nice that the episode started with Chuck essentially like doing a numbers being transposed related con, and then like the episode ends with like them dealing with the fallout of Jimmy doing a numbers transpose related con.
Yes, you almost wonder if Jimmy almost got inspired by what his brother said years earlier. I caught that. I thought that was a nice little detail that they got in there. I also, I mean, and also with that flashback, it's interesting just to see the lengths that Jimmy really goes to in hopes of helping his brother, like, reconcile with his ex-wife, which is something we've been wondering about because we've not yet gotten an explanation about what happened between those two. But we learned something kind of important, that their breakup had nothing to do, at least as far as she knows, had nothing to do with electromagnetic allergy situation, that she wasn't even aware of it. So it's interesting in that episode the lengths Chuck goes to hide that. And even though Jimmy's insisting on telling her, but the way Chuck is so adamant, I think that really plays a part about his character and what we see in what goes on in the present day storyline as well.
He definitely is a prideful person, and we saw plenty of smug superior soupy. What am I trying to say, Scott?
Superego? I'm not sure. Superior? Arrogance? He's an arrogant guy. And again, yes, and pride. Oh, it's all about pride. And look, once again, pride is the sin that plagues a character on a Vince Gilligan TV show. Go figure. But I kind of wondered if maybe even their breakup might have been him trying to hide this, and maybe he let their breakup happen over false reasons. Because I think it becomes clear in the flashback that whatever what she's doing, which I think she a musician? Is that why she's traveling so much?
Yes.
Right. Well, he can't travel in his condition, so I wonder if he created some false reason that ended up leading to their breakup, so that she could almost being sacrificial in a way, so that she could live this life that she's doing. Because there's no way he could possibly do that. I mean, I don't think Chuck could ever get on an airplane. I don't think that's even possible.
No, it's certainly possible. I have the impression that Chuck's electromagnetic sensitivity is, I think it's Jimmy related, because maybe I'm not really sure exactly why, because he definitely has like issues blaming Jimmy for like, stuff going down with their dad and all that, and just hates the concept of him being a lawyer. But I'm wondering if like he feels guilty about that too. I mean, this definitely takes place like after Chuck has already kind of screwed Jimmy out of an HHM job, because Jimmy is a lawyer at this point, and then pretty much the next thing that happened was that. So he definitely, it's has I guess low grade electromagnetic sensitivity at this moment, but
Well,
I think there's at least a chance that that's part of it.
I think what happens over the course of this episode, and it's kind of funny, I think we essentially forgot something that happened, might have been all the way back in season one, come to think of it. When we saw that doctor, when Chuck was in the hospital and he discreetly turns on the electronics under the bed and he doesn't react, that it's kind of sort of already been proven that this is more a delusion than anything else. And it took, this episode to really make that point to everybody else, because Chuck's disease, it's mental. It's a mental issue. It's not, he doesn't actually have a physical issue. And I think that's what this episode was about, proving to everyone else. Even if it ends up being a far worse outcome for Chuck than what he had ever planned for Jimmy, quite frankly.
Yeah, because like, I'm not sure exactly how these disbarment type things work, but I wouldn't think that Chuck being outed as like having a serious mental issue would exactly do, like, you know, do him any favors. I mean, he's not, like, up there on the, you know, under charges for anything, but I could definitely see them using some kind of medical reason and, you know, at least give him a suspension. I'm presuming that Jimmy will at least get some kind of suspension out of this, if not completely, you know, rather than being completely disbarred. So maybe both brothers are going to be, put on a 1 year or something, no lawyering.
I think Jimmy's going to pretty much be okay from this, because it looks more like it's a brotherly squabble that they're not going to want a part of. I mean, if anything, if he gets a suspension, it'll be a very brief one. I would be very surprised if it's anything more than that.
Right, because they definitely established that he broke the law in front of these guys, so, I mean, they know that he didn't exactly whatever, but he might have, colored it.
But they also make the point that, and it's actually when... Chuck's psychosis becomes more and more evident to them when they're all staring at him having had this meltdown, and you realize what this is all really about. It's not about any of what Chuck had said it was about. Then it's not a stretch to believe that Jimmy said what he said just to try to make his brother feel better because of the condition his brother is in and the way his brother is. And that's going to be the linchpin that Jimmy and Kim are using here. And then, so...
Yeah,
yeah, and if they believe there's even a, if they believe that's possible, you know, it's just like, you know, something like a courtroom, you know, plausible doubt, believe whatever the phrase is, then Jimmy gets away with it, because look, when you see what Chuck does here, what they cause Chuck to do, it's like, oh, okay, now we see why you might have said whatever you said just to appease him, because he's off his rocker.
Yeah, and they've done enough to establish that, like, he can actually, like, they could call a Clea Duvall's doctor character to the stand, and she would be able to testify that, like, yeah, Jimmy was aware of the fact that, you know, this was psychological, not physiological.
Right.
You know, as far back as a couple of years ago or a year, however long it's been. So they definitely, I mean, you know, he can, you know, if they use that angle as their defense, I mean, it can be an, you know, open and shut case there.
Right. I mean, I will admit that I was pretty certain I knew what Jimmy was up to way early on in the episode when they were first talking about hiring a pickpocket from Mike's veterinary connection over there from the senior side of New Mexico, I guess.
Yeah,
and I knew it was going to be Huell when they made that comment about does it have to be in a small space or not or something like that. It's like, oh, because it's a big guy, it's got to be Huell from Breaking Bad, even though that guy's lost a considerable amount of weight, so you can say it's before he blew up way bigger than he is here. The only thing I didn't know if it was going to be a battery. I just knew it couldn't be a phone because I knew Chuck would be aware of a phone on him. It's just that has too much weight on it. I didn't make the connection it would be like the battery in it, which he's often talked about being really sensitive to the batteries. Hence Jimmy pulling the shtick with the phone in his pocket, which didn't have a battery in it. So that was it was really well orchestrated, but. What's really sad about the episode is that we see from both the flashback and all the present-day actions, Jimmy really does love his brother, but with Chuck, it's so much less clear. I mean, we watch him rehearsing and practicing how he feels, and I thought that tirade of his at the end really unleashes, you know, it's not just anger, but it's jealousy. And it's everything that Chuck says and probably so much more that he doesn't say. You know, his sanctimonious chest beating about the law, I think it's pretty much shown to be a facade. Because Jimmy to him, he's the kid who got away with everything. He brings up the stealing from the drawer at the father's store. And you can know he's probably thinking and saying, you know, Jimmy was the popular one. Jimmy was the likable one. So I think this is like a really deep-seated resentment that's been born out of decade after decade. After something that I think is less an ongoing rivalry, it was something much more than that. It was a rivalry that Jimmy wasn't aware that he was part of, kind of, you know. So
yeah,
and I think everything Chuck tried to do over the years was always not just trying to keep Jimmy at arm's length, but, you know, kind of like just keeping himself in a position of power or control, I guess, if that makes any sense. Like almost to subjugate Jimmy.
Yeah,
I mean,
I did find it. The fact that, like, you know, I'd say we both probably enjoyed seeing Jimmy's scheme work out well, because we tend to be, you know, we're on Jimmy's side. But our, you know, you and me definitely seem to be you know, more so than like the rest of the internet in general, we do tend to like actually like, you know, make an effort to understand where Chuck's coming from, and we don't really hate him like the average people just, you know, do as a knee-jerk reaction. And I don't know about you, but it was, I mean, even though I was glad that Jimmy's plan was working and it was super entertaining, I mean, I was not happy watching Chuck just completely unravel there. You know, I mean, the guy's definitely an asshole, but, you know, in some ways I can, you know, see where he's coming from. And, it you know, I took no pleasure out of that.
I tend to agree. I mean, my pleasure was just in how well done the scene was, how well done the acting was. But I wasn't like clapping my hands saying, yeah, beyond the fact that, you know, Jim and Kimmy's plan came to fruition. But here's the thing, going with what you're saying, what separates what they did from the typical kind of capers and schemes we see, you know, undertaken on any number of TV shows or movies, or even on this one, quite frankly, is, you know, like, although like last week you had that really satisfying spring to their step when they walked out of the, walked on that corridor at the end of the episode, I think this week the full gravity of what they were undertaking and truly the irrevocable harm it's going to do, not just to the McGill family, but also either brother's relationship with Rebecca and Chuck's forever standing among his peers, his law firm and community. It, like I said before, this is a much harsher outcome for Chuck than what Chuck had planned for Jimmy, because, you know, this is Chuck's life, whereas lawyering for Jimmy, I think it's a means to an end. It's a way he's been able to use his fast-talking skills to mostly legitimate use, I guess, and make a buck or two. But, you know, if Jimmy's not a lawyer, there's a million other things he could do. He's a natural-born salesman, you know, Christ, even without... If not for that the Chicago sunroof thing, he could probably even be a politician. But what this does to Chuck, you could see that Jimmy and Kim, they took no pleasure in this during the course of the entire episode. You could see that they were being forced to do this, it seemed like. You know, there was definitely remorse and regret throughout the episode, you know, written all over Jimmy's face and Kim as well. But they were forced in this position by the way Chuck was treating them and handling things. So it's sad, but it's hard not to say he didn't get what he deserved, you know?
Nope, definitely true. He definitely needed to be knocked down a peg. I thought it was nice to see Kim's legal skills being used so well. I mean, she definitely was able to go, you know, toe-to-toe with Howard without you know, very many issues. And I really loved when they, you know, totally punked him on the nepotism thing, because, I mean...
That was fantastic.
Yeah, so good. I definitely like the little ways that they're showing, like, Jimmy and Kim's relationship is, you know, progressing and stuff without, you know, needing to go, like, into a huge, like, you know, flowery monologue or something about it.
Right.
I mean, just we've been seeing, like, you know, a little bit of, you know, more and more connections over the last couple episodes. And this one, I kind of liked how they showed, like, their two toothbrushes together, you know, just kind of like, you know. You know, center frame, just part of, like, the set piece, but just kind of, like, a nice little way to show, like, you know, or remind us, like, how their relationship is going.
Absolutely. I mean, Kim plays a huge part in all this and in Jimmy's life as a whole, you know, and this goes beyond anything she's ever collaborated with Jimmy on before. I mean, I'm going to say that the Kim we meet very briefly back in season one, episode one, I don't think she's going to be making the same choices or show the same amount of faith even in Jimmy that season three Kim is clearly able to do. Because, you know, because she's changed also. Like, she's gotten more insight into Jimmy, and I think she understands him even more than she did before. And, you know, she's had her problems, she's had her issues with him, but she's sticking with him. I mean, she knows he did these things, you know, and the fact that he did it for her, you know, it's a romantic gesture to a certain degree, but
yeah, that kind of thing is very alluring. Plus, she, you know, then she has a nice, you know, less than stellar example of how Chuck is treating Jimmy. So, I mean, it's fair. I would take Jimmy's side if I was her. No hesitation at all.
Right. Absolutely.
I do definitely seem, you know, they did have a little bit of a, I'd say, foreshadowing that, like, no, the Mesa Verde thing probably is going to go to shit. I really hope not. But, I mean, it definitely seemed like, you know, they probably won't get through that one completely unscathed.
Yeah, they're dropping hints there, just in that scene when she has with the two people from Mesa Verde. The fact that the woman is still kind of questioning, are you sure we're going to be okay? It's like, oh, yeah, sure. It's like, whenever you hear that, it's like, no, it's not going to be okay. Something's going to go wrong. And it might be due to this case. Oh, it should be due to this case, quite frankly. But I guess we'll see how that unfolds. By the way, did you happen to see, or should I say even hear, the ad for the next episode at the end of the episode or not?
No, I never. I always turn it off before I get to that point.
Okay, I was just curious because I swear I heard a name said in the next episode, and I was like, wait a minute. There's no way they're getting to that now. That, of course, this show, I mean, and Gilligan and Gould are primed to throw a curveball at us at any point in time. So, but I thought I heard the name Saul Goodman mentioned, which made me go, wait, what? What? No, what now? Why? Again, I might have misheard it, or it might be a red herring of some kind. I don't know.
They could do it. They could have some kind of gene scene, and then that's where the audio is from. I mean, who knows?
Possibly. I can't. Hey, by the way, in the first two seasons, before I move on to one other question I had, I know each of the first two seasons began with the Nebraska gene black and white scene, or three seasons, I should say now, actually. I can't. I apologize for drawing a blank. It's just, you know, the way life is now for me. Did they, in either seasons one or two, did they bounce back to that at the end of the season at all? Or was it only the beginning and we never went back later on? I can't remember them going back. I feel like...
I think we've only seen the three scenes. The one that ends with him watching the Saul commercial tape. The one where he gets locked in the, like, dumpster room thing. And then this one where he ends up collapsing at the end. I'm pretty sure we haven't seen any other gene action.
All right, I was pretty sure about that as well. I just want to make sure because every once in a while make a mistake like that, and then I hear about it later like, oh, God. Okay, so one thing I want to ask or bring up, since you've mentioned it, I've mentioned it, we both mentioned it. Do you think we're going to get to something by the end of the season where we see that tinfoil house get baked like a potato? Because... It feels like they're throwing flags at us right and left about the possibility of a fire happening.
They definitely seem to be stoking the flames of that fan theory. Us being fans, but I'm hoping they don't get to it this soon. But if they do, I mean, I think we know it's going to be awesome. I would be fine if they take their sweet time before they escalate the situation in that way.
Okay, before I say it, because I don't want—I mean, I'll have you cover your ears for a second. If I say what the one-word title is for the final episode of the season, that might tell you why I was asking. Do you want to know what the title is, or are you like, I don't even want to know what the title is?
Yeah, that's fine. I saw what they were the other day. I just didn't notice the last one. I saw one was like, you know, so there two of them were Slip and Jimmy related. But I didn't notice what the final one was.
The final episode's title is Lantern. So, and we keep talking about those lanterns being the cause of, you know, a potential bonfire in that house. So, naming the episode Lantern, I'm assuming they're not talking about Green Lantern. So that would be really cool.
I guess it'd be, you know, it would be cool if, I mean, we've been talking about the possibility of lantern related fire stuff. I mean, for a long, long time, and I don't think I've seen, you know, I listen to some podcasts about the show, and I, you know, read Seppenwall, whatever, and as far as I know, I haven't seen anybody except us talk about it, so if that ends up being true, it'll be, you know, cool, good job us, understanding how TV is made.
Right. The only thing that gives me pause about to saying that it's definitely going to happen is the fact that they went out of their way to title the episode Lantern almost makes it too obvious because they keep talking about that lantern and it being a fire hazard on top of those newspapers. And we thought about that in previous episode, previous seasons as well. But it's definitely something that to be on the lookout for. I think it's very possible.
Yeah, it's pretty on the nose for these guys. But I mean, I guess we will see.
We will see. All right. So should we head up north or what? Are we heading up north now? I feel like we can head up north.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I think, yep.
So let's head up north to visit the very twisted world of Fargo. Now, the latest episode of Fargo was titled The Narrow Escape Problem. It was written by Monica Bieletsky, who actually also wrote the penultimate episode of the second season of The Leftovers, and she also has an episode of Friday Night Lights on her writing resume. My favorite thing about her credits, if you really dig into them, she was actually on the production staff of Lost for one episode, but it was but it was the constant, so that's pretty cool. And of course, the episode was directed by Michael Uppendahl, who we've spoken about several times over the past few months in regards to his considerable directing resume. As for the meaning of the title, back-to-back weeks, it does not have anything to do with Bridge, but instead, the narrow escape problem, that's something that you would encounter in the world of biology or biophysics or even cellular biology. Now, as I essentially read what I've cribbed from Wikipedia here, or my Wikipedia enhanced notes, as I call them, let's see if you can break this down into something a bit clearer that plays as an analogy for either this episode or the show in general. So okay. The definition is a Brownian particle, which is an ion, a molecule, or a protein, is confined to a bounded domain, such as a compartment or a cell, by a reflecting boundary, except for a small window through which it can escape. The narrow escape problem is that of calculating the mean escape time. So the time, this time that diverges as that window shrinks, thus rendering the calculation, I love this, a singular perturbation problem. Now, for everyone out there who doesn't know what perturbation is, it's not being annoyed while you jerk off. It's actually the alteration of the function of a biological system, which is induced by either external or internal mechanisms. Now, that sounds like a whole lot of highfalutin words and everything, but if you just break it down, that it's really about something. You're trapped in a situation, and you see a way to get out, but you have to figure out how to do it and time it correctly, because the opportunity to get out of that situation changes, you know, from moment to moment. So that's really what that means, essentially. And you can kind of like relate that to really what's going on with the Stussy brothers, I guess, more than anything else, as far as, you know, trying to find a way out of a situation. And you plan ahead, but if you don't plan correctly, you miss your window out of it, and then it closes on you, I think. So this episode, following one that we loved last week's episode, correct? We loved that episode.
Oh yeah,
a couple people out there didn't. I don't know what to tell you, people. You're in the wrong.
And also soulless.
Yes, and you're
and there's no magic in your lives.
And your lack of sophistication saddens me.
So, and you like bad pizza.
Oh well. So, getting to this episode, the opening, which I. Once I heard it, I recognized it immediately from my own childhood, and not even just hearing it at school, but at home. I remember my mother had this amazing version of Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf. But it took me at least a good minute or two to realize that was Billy Bob Thornton as a narrator. So he wasn't actually playing the record. They were doing a new version of it with Billy Bob Thornton. Did you realize that was Billy Bob right off the bat, or did it take you a little while to pick up on that?
Yeah, I picked up on it like within, I don't know, probably, you know, 5 seconds or so. But I just watched the first couple episodes of season one not very long ago, so that probably helped. It didn't, and then after that, and it's like, oh, they had Martin Freeman.
Not Martin Freeman, wrong guy.
Yeah.
Although they've used him in a previous episode.
But they had Martin Freeman do a narration, I think, last season. So
yeah.
And it's like, oh, they're using both of their season one bad boys. And I thought that was nice of them to do. Cool.
Right. Now, I'm sure there's going to be some who might think that Noah Hawley's musical choice here was maybe once again a bit on the self-indulgent side. I personally didn't feel that way. I thought it was, not only did I think it was fun, but I thought it was a really nice touchstone that they could use throughout the episode. You know, Weta was playing like the bird and the duck themes for the Stussy brothers, or Gloria having the hero theme of Peter, or Vargas as the wolf, although apparently a wolf was a bulimic. But the overall episode, I mean, I'll say right from the get-go, if you don't know, we'll have to wait till the end of the episode. I really like this episode. This episode, these two episodes back to back have really helped restore a good portion of the faith I had, kind of slipping away in the first two episodes for me.
Yeah, same here. I mean, the story is definitely moving a little bit slower than the it tends to do on this show. You know, there's been a lot of setup going on, but I really don't give a crap. They're moving the pieces into configuration that's should make for a really fun, explosive story. So I don't mind the slow build up, and did take a little while to give a crap about most of these characters.
Right, but I think at this point, I think the train is in motion. I think we do have some forward progression. I mean, the thing that's keeping it from being super fast and crazy is, well, they're not killing people right and left, which kind of sort of happened. It certainly happened in season two.
Right. Yeah, we haven't had anything like that big gunfight in the forest that they did in the third or fourth episode of season two. Right. I think the third episode. And I'm sure we're waiting for something crazy like that to happen. I have no idea what would happen with the way they've got the story set up so far. But I'm looking forward to when they do that, whatever crazy thing we have to. It's like, oh my god!
Oh, you know it's going to happen. I mean, what they're doing. I mean, in a way, it seems weird to call it this because of the way I feel about the first two seasons of the show. But it's kind of following the more standard Fargo formula, at least that very much the one from season one, perhaps a lot more than season two. And it just, the trick was season one, they got things going a lot faster because there was, you had two things. You had a more visceral crime that was shocking from the get-go. And then you had kind of like the villain and who we thought was sort of kind of a hero, but not really. And then you realize, oh, it's the transformation of, oh, he's a bad guy too. And it just became more, and then we're like, oh, we got to follow the cops. They're the good guys. Martin Freeman, he's a bad guy. So you don't have that as much at play here. Although, I mean, and if you do, it's to a much lesser or a much less interesting degree. I mean, but to this episode, I'll admit, I think the Stussy brothers, to a certain extent, they're finally getting at least a little bit more interesting. And
yeah.
I think here, it's because they're finally being active instead of reactive and relying on other people to take action. You know, I mean, especially Ray in this episode, because he was really, yes, he's being manipulated by Nikki. And I love that his boss pretty much says it later in the episode, and we're like, yeah, that's exactly what's happening. But from his impersonating shenanigans, or maybe I should use the word chicanery, that should be the word of the night, or how he sacrifices his job for her, and the whole thing, he's really just kind of just pushing the story forward finally on his own, and which makes it just makes him a more interesting character to follow, I think, as a result of that. Because I just mentioned it, and then I'll shut up for a moment to let you actually talk here. I mentioned that his boss has that line about how she's manipulating you, and he pretty much says what's happening. And I do like how the show can get away with some really on-the-nose lines, just so there's no denying anything. It's very clear to the... There's always that moment where the viewer can be like, ah, okay, you're telling me right now. It's like last week when Gloria says, it's just a story, it doesn't mean anything, which is basically that episode in a nutshell. or even how the season started with that whole 1988 East Berlin thing, with that whole commentary about what is truth, which was just implanting a flag leading into the phrase, this is a true story, just telling you, truth is whatever you say it is. And then we add that reference in this very episode with that Yuri character talking about the different types of truth from Russia, which was a very weird sequence conversation, which maybe we'll talk about in a few minutes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, okay, I'll talk about it now, actually. I like that they were having fun with that moment because he's not just telling the story to someone. He's telling a specific story or a conversation, but in different places. He's telling it to Vargas in the trailer. Then he's chatting with that silent Mimo character in the car, but they make it like it's all one conversation that takes place in all these different times and places. It was very strange. And again, it's one of those things, there's no real reason for this. I mean, we're not beyond the fact we're talking about the nature of truth again. So that seems to be at play a lot in this episode. And I'm hesitant to say this, but you kind of wonder if they're making a commentary about what's going on in real life right now, which I've actually been seeing pop up on different TV shows here and there.
I definitely got the impression that they kind of were going in that direction.
Yeah, I didn't realize until this week that these episodes are being filmed fairly recently. That these weren't in the can like several months ago or whatever. They may even still be filming the show right now. For all I know, they're filming really up to date with this show, which is very strange. But I didn't know that until this week. So I was like, wow. So therefore, having that affect the script and the story is not a surprise. So Gloria, who apparently is invisible to all technology except our own TVs, she meets this fellow female officer. I love this new character, Officer Winnie Lopez. I just love the addition. I mean, I this is a show where I look forward to adding more characters, because the more characters, the better, because they tend to be out there and fun or something. It's rare that we get a character like, oh, I didn't like that one. Because there is at least one character on the show I could really do without. But I really enjoyed adding that character into the mix, even though I was like, wow, are they gonna work menstruation into every other episode here? Because I mean, I know a woman wrote this episode. I don't think there's anything to do with it. So, but it's just a little weird to have an extended conversation again about something like that. What did you think of the new character?
Yeah, I thought she was pretty cool. I definitely fits with this kind of story, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with it. Definitely, you know, got the impression that she, you know, that there's a little peril in her general direction, since those two henchman type characters were, you know, totally mad dogging her when she was talking to Sai. But as of now, she is still kicking.
Yeah, I will confess, I was also getting quite concerned at that moment, which also said something about a character that we've just met, that I was actually going, no. Oh, don't yeah. Kill her.
And I thought that one of us was going to get in the elevator with her.
Yeah, I was watching that really close. It's like, don't get on the elevator. Because once that elevator was closed, like, okay, she's safe enough. Keeping in mind, however, it would be an incredibly stupid move for them to kill a cop in this way. You know,
yeah.
Like not on some abandoned road somewhere, a la, I think, the original Fargo movie, actually. But when she's obviously probably... They know of her whereabouts. They know that she was going somewhere at a certain point. So you'd end up having, you know, any number of police there as a result. So, which is probably more the reason why they wouldn't have done anything. But I was worried for her sake, most definitely. Since we're talking about it, that scene with her and Sai, one of my favorite scenes in the entire thing. I get such a huge kick out of Sai. I think he's hysterical. But I just love it. It's like, I didn't ask you, and everything he's saying really has no connection to anything. It's like, because he's got another huge problem to deal with, because what good is the HR person? He was the one driving. There's no way around that. And it's kind of funny that his stupidity of being angry enough to keep smashing into Ray's car, but then like clipping that other person's car, that one little thing is going to set everything else in motion. Of course, yeah. The funny thing is, what I think it's going to really set in motion is screwing Ray, which he kind of wants to do anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so in a way, he, you know, him going out there to threaten him like a moron, which was really funny. He's like, I'm watching you, or he shows him his fist or something like that, like he's Mr. Cool, and then he lamely tries to get into the Humvee, and he slips or something, or he can't open the door or something like that.
Yeah, he's dipping at the door, right? But it was pretty funny, though. You know, just he's just pointing at him like the whole time, and then he pulls away, and you know, he's got those big old freaking, I don't know, things on the tires.
Right. But he's definitely one of the more fun characters and one of the people I look forward to every scene. So on the not so great side, okay, the new chief, the Shay, who's played by Shay Whigham, who I like from Boardwalk Empire and a couple other shows over the years. I don't know that this character just doesn't seem to be fitting here for me. I know they can have characters that can be a bit on the cartoonish side, borderline caricature, but he's playing something so broad. I'm not believing his character, and it's kind of bugging me a little bit. I wish they'd come up with something a far more interesting obstacle, type of character for her to bounce off of than this. I'm really finding those scenes annoying, quite frankly.
Yeah, it's just been like mindless obstinance. It's just not. At least if it was like something we'd see in an earlier season, Bob Odenkirk's character, just like at least he would have some reason for like, hey, don't investigate this, and like it was actually authentic. This guy's kind of just like, okay, we need to write an obstacle to this character. Everybody loves Carrie Coon, so let's just make this guy a big douchebag. But it, you know, but I definitely agree, it doesn't really, fit in with the kind of characters we see in this show in general.
It's just, yeah, it's just not believable. And right, at least the Odenkirk character, I mean, he was frustrating, but you could kind of believe it by, and he had little moments of slight redemption, at least, with that character.
Yeah.
This one, I mean, he might have a moment like that at some point, but right now, it's just annoying. And I think they dropped the ball a little bit here. I would never accuse a show like this of lazy writing. It's not lazy writing. But it feels like they just slapped something together. Like, oh, he's a former army guy, so he's going to keep talking about the crap he's on in Fallujah and stuff like that, and even though it has nothing to do with anything.
I
So.
did kind of enjoy how Gloria listened to his like rant about like whatever, and she's just like, well, I'm just gonna do it anyway, and just walked out. And so I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, I enjoyed her walking out and just like, yeah, whatever. But it was time wasted for me. I just wish they'd come up with a better character there.
Yeah.
It could have been someone standing in her way, but it could have been written and done in a much more interesting way. I mean, I love the idea of there being a new chief and she's the old chief, and that you have that constant confusion going on, because it's all about it's one of the themes of people being misidentified. Because people are misidentifying her as a chief, and she keeps having to have that explanation. She's like, well, not exactly. Well, not for long, or that kind of a thing. But to be just a total dick and not even have any, I don't be, I just don't believe the character. So that they blew it a little bit on that one. I would say, I guess I liked Emmett somewhat more in this episode than the first two. I still need to see something more with him. So, but I feel there's a way they can pull it off for me. I don't know if you agree. Will agree might, you, I think you might agree with me on this,
Yeah.
because I think by the end of the episode, when he's being enticed by Vargas about the possibility of what being truly rich is, and so on and so forth, I'm hoping that by basically signing this deal with the devil, so to speak. That maybe once he starts to, embrace the evil, I guess, that he's led into his company, the wolf he's led into his home, so to speak, ha ha. Then he just might get a little bit more interesting. It's kind of
Yeah.
the corrupted soul, because before this, you could see that, maybe he did screw his brother over, but he definitely has a certain amount of regret or remorse about it, and it's his lawyer who's kind of kept him from really. Trying to really make good to his brother, I think. But now, if he just totally goes in this, warped evil direction, I'm curious to see where that'll take him. I mean, we see the lengths that Ray is going to now. I'm kind of curious to see if Emmett goes in that direction as well.
Right, like right now, I mean, I can definitely like I'm starting to like it, like you said, starting to like Emmett a little bit more. He kind of has like I like him in the way like we'll like Roger Thornhill in North by Northwest, like he's the circumstances like of a situation like aren't really his fault, that kind of thing. It's not like a mistaken identity type thing, but this is the kind of thing where like he doesn't really like deserve this crap, probably, so we can kind of, like, you know, feel for him and identify with him a little bit. But it'll be interesting to see if they end up, like, you know, how far they push him and if they turn him into a, you know,
I never imagine comparing Roger Thornhill to Emmett Stussy, because he's probably missing one thing. Like, he doesn't exactly have the Cary Grant charm.
Not a direct comparison, but just in the way, like, you know, relate to him.
But still, I mean, overall, like I said before, I think these last two episodes are so much far and away better than the first two. I mean, I've come to grips with the fact that I, at this point, don't believe that season three is going to be as good as one or two. But
no, I don't. It's the kind of thing where, like, if, you know, I don't think we're going to really, you know, if other show wins, like, best Emmy for whatever the fuck, I don't think we're going to be too upset that the season of Fargo isn't wrecking. I mean, maybe they'll turn it around, but I really don't see that happening. And I, you know, as well as the fact that it's airing against a season of Saul that does not have very many faults, isn't doing it any favors. Since, and plus, you know, we're talking about both shows at the same time.
Right.
Maybe if it aired in a few months, we'd be a little bit more forgiving of it. But it, you know, it definitely has potential, and it's getting better, and I think it'll be worth our time.
Yeah,
but it's definitely no seasons one or two.
No, it's good. It's enjoyable. It's not going to be my number one show of the year. That's clear. And as far as the Emmys are concerned, because I know Fargo falls into the limited series category for whatever reason. I've already seen shows that have already aired that will compete in that category that I think will deserve an award. Like the show Feud, that was about Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. I would say that deserves it more than this does, which is shocking for me to say that, but it was really, just really well done and a lot of fun.
We might be seeing, like, maybe Noah Hawley's just a little bit overextended, because he doesn't seem to be, you know, like, he's not writing every single episode of this, like, you know, he tends to do before. So I think that definitely might be, you know, like, you know, yeah, they're good writers. Yeah, they're doing a solid job. But I just think, you know, maybe he burned out his creative juices doing Legion, which we certainly benefited from.
True.
But maybe it was a little bit, you know, just bit off a little more than he could chew, and the writing staff just isn't quite, you know, like the Saul writers were. I mean, they just, like, you know, are just simpatico, and whoever they put in there is just right. Awesome. I didn't say about this earlier, but, like, Gordon Smith, you know, coming up as a writer's assistant at Breaking Bad, just writing these just amazing episodes of Better Call Saul, like, season to season to season. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, good job, that guy. I mean, interesting to see what he ends up doing in the future, because, I mean, good fucking writer. But anyway, back to...
Oh, yeah. Well, it's always good when you start being able to identify writers on shows who develop a track record, who aren't necessarily the series creators, but those are the guys, or gals, who may very well go on to be series creators themselves, like a Vince Gilligan, like so many others over the years. That one can think of, they often start out as being part of other staffs originally. So that could be the case with someone like him, for example. My friend, who's a listener, so we'll give her a shout out. Hey, Adrian. She actually had a good line the other day. We were talking about Fargo. And she was saying, well, maybe, because some shows, you know, they have what they call the sophomore slump. Maybe Fargo's having a junior slump. And it took me like a second to realize what she meant. Like, oh, yeah, junior high school. Oh, yeah, the following year. Oh, you know, maybe that's it. I mean, we lucked out by them having such a great second season, so it would have been hard to top the one, at least as far as I'm concerned, to begin with. So that's also hurting the show by comparison, because it also feels like it's kind of going through some of the similar motions that we saw a lot more in season one than in season two. And also, maybe, I haven't really thought about this, but maybe not having any Salverson family connection kind of makes me sad a little bit. I like that connection between the first two seasons. So I, knowing this is 2010, there's part of me that's like, really, we can't see Molly and Gus anywhere. They're still around. For all I know, they could have a cameo at some point in the season. Who the heck knows? But that's not what I mean. But again, I'm enjoying the show. I'll tell you this. I'm glad that we've restructured the format of the podcast so that we end up just spending, like, you know, a half an hour or less talking about it, as opposed to our sometimes rather expanded coverage of some of those episodes in season
Yeah.
two, because I don't know if I'd be wanting to do an exhaustive hour and a half on every episode of Fargo this season.
No.
It would be kind of depressing for me. I'd be like, I'd rather spend 10 minutes talking about American Gods or The Leftovers or something else than if we're going to talk for any longer than that.
Yeah, that it has worked well. I mean, neither one of us has really had time to be doing, a zillion podcast at the moment. And I think, I'd say we've talked about everything we want to talk about. With just covering the variety of, me gushing over the cinematography on Saul, or us just, comparing this to that.
Yep.
I think we're getting her done. So I don't know how somehow we ended up becoming concise in 2017.
Yeah,
maybe the crappy election in 2016, murdering everybody that we love. Maybe that killed our spirit, the part that makes us just talk. But
I'm
not complaining.
It only took us 3 years to get the hang of this. That's fine. The only thing I just want to say, and then we can move into wrapping this up, is it is nice, and I think it's worth acknowledging. And if I said it earlier, I apologize for repeating myself, but I don't remember if I said it or not, because I know I said it about this show. Both the series we talk about, I think their last two episodes have been the best two episodes of the season so far for both shows. I think these are easily the two best. Three and four are easily better than one and two of Fargo this season. But the last two Better Call Saul episodes, and I've loved all the episodes, but these last two, I think, are definitely the strongest. Definitely, I mean, I would actually even go as far as say, I think the last two Better Call Saul episodes are practically flawless as far as I'm concerned. Those are...
Yeah, they're as good as anything they've done on that show. And no, it's not that they've ever done anything bad, but yeah, it's just completely kicking ass. And for some reason, I thought this week's episode was episode six of Saul. So when I saw it was five, and I had like five more episodes left instead of four, I'm just like, yes! I was just so happy.
We're only at the midway point, and they're as good as they have been this season. So really well done. If we were talking about that show on another podcast that we do together, I would have we both where we grade shows, we each have like two sixes we're allowed to give, because it's usually a scale of 0 to 5. I would have wasted my sixes on the last two Better Call Saul episodes for sure, and I'd be like, wait a minute,
nice.
There might still be five more. All right,
yeah.
I'm making a new rule. We get three sixes. Wait, 666. That's what I said. Alrighty then. I love that we've done this in a timely fashion, so I think we can wrap this up.
Yep, let's do it.
So let's get the wrap up started. If you enjoyed this podcast, you'll probably enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. You can find us on Facebook as the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Fargo, Better Call Saul, and so many others. You can also find us on iTunes pretty much the same way. Serious TV Drama Podcast. Type that in. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us. And finally, you can follow us on Twitter. On the Twitter, where handle is at STVD Podcast. It's STVD as in Serious TV Drama. And that's all for this podcast tonight. We'll, of course, be back next week to bring you the next two episodes of Fargo and Better Call Saul. We're going to be suiting up in a few minutes to get ready to do another podcast about some other shows that probably aren't quite as good as these, but we still have fun talking about them. At least some weeks we do, not all weeks. But
yeah.
I'm glad that we were able to get together and get this sucker banged out here.
Yep, good shit. So, yep, thanks for listening, everybody. And Scott, have a good night until I talk to you in like a minute and a half again.
And good night to you and everyone else out there as well.